Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin of Mishkin Law in Chicago. I'm joined today by my co-host, Rob Hunt of Lanay Holdings out in lovely California. And we have a wonderful, wonderful show to you for you today. Our music focus is going to be on the other Barton Hall show, since we've already talked about the first Barton Hall show. And this other one is dated May 16th, 1981. And before we do anything else, let's dive in and get a taste of it. Dan, what do you got for us? Okay, Rob, so let's get to the bottom of this right away. I know why you picked that tune to start the show off. You and Bleatstein got on the phone and said, let's pimp Mishkin for having that stupid opinion on it a few weeks ago. Am I right?
That's so funny, but no, you're not. I picked it because I don't think there's anything else from an 81 show that really typifies Garcia's style of playing like half a beat faster than he did on a lot of other songs. Like whenever I think of 81 shows, I always think that they're just a little bit quicker. I think it started like when Brent joined in 79, and the next couple of years were just things that used to be slowed down were just now clipping along, right? And that Brown Eyed, it's so clean, note for note clean of Garcia picking, that I figured I'd just start off with that one. But I totally forgot about the Bleatstein thing. I totally forgot about your opinion of Brown Eyed.
Well, I'm just going to reframe that right now for the whole world, okay? Let me go back and say that I've always loved Brown Eyed Woman. It's a great tune. I've always enjoyed hearing it. And I think what I was trying to say is I'm not sure that I ever was at a show where I came out at the end of the night and said, wow, that Brown Eyed Woman was the song of the night. But it was always a very nice compliment to whatever they were playing, and I did enjoy hearing it. So let's just say it that way and forget the other one never happened.
All right, we'll put it behind us. But
Bleatstein, and whoever was listening that day.
But I will say that, you know, we picked the show today because obviously, you know, we're airing this on May 16th, and I love 81. I think 81's an overlooked year. I think that it doesn't get nearly as much credit as it should. At this point, Brent's, you know, pretty well settled into the band. I think that when you think Barton Hall, everyone always thinks of just one show. I mean, it's 5877, sucks the oxygen out of the room for everything. I don't think people even realize they played Cornell again. They played Cornell a few times. But if you actually look at this 81 show, it's solid top to bottom. It's just I think it was even put out as a disc as well. So, you know, it just doesn't get the credit. And I don't understand why. It's not like it's one of those things that was never traded as a tape where everyone's like, oh, yeah, but have you ever heard the 81 Barton Hall? And so I wanted to give it a little bit of love today.
No, I think that's great. And, you know, it is an excellent show. I have listened to it before, but I would agree with you that, you know, when you're the location of what, you know, many would consider, and we've talked about that too, the greatest Grateful Dead show of all time, any other show that gets played in that venue, whether fair or not, is going to necessarily get measured against that one. And in doing so, I would have to agree. I think this one holds up pretty well.
But that's like saying that you should only listen to like 1231/78 from Winterland, right?
Right.
There's so many other ridiculously sick Winterland shows that, you know, you say, okay, like it's just, I only measure every other Winterland show against like, you know, the closing of, right?
I agree, but I mean, and I'm not the one who started the whole thing about, May 8th, 77 being the greatest show of all time, but it is a damn good show. And, you know, I think just because it has that kind of notoriety to it, you know, in a good way, that people say, well, boy, Barton Hall, and you're right, the first thing we go to is 77, but in doing so, a lot of good shows get lost along the way. And, you know, hey, that's our job to make sure that our listeners and everyone else out there don't forget about them.
Definitely. Definitely. So I think we'll be talking about that one a bit more over the next bit of time. But, you know, in the interim, we're really lucky today because we've got a great guest. We've got Stacy Smith, who's joining us. Stacy is a longtime Grateful Dead fan who grew up in the Bay Area. And we'll let her tell a little bit of her story about growing up out there. But she is an Atherton, California gal. Seen a ton of shows and has now migrated her way back to the Northeast and is a cannabis cultivator and has her own media company called Stranger Stopping Strangers. So, you know, obviously a big Scarlet fan as well. But Stacy, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I am good. I am chomping at the bit to start jumping in about 81.
Well, have at it. Yeah, let's hear it.
Have at it. I didn't want to interrupt. I'm a classic interrupter.
Please.
So here's my theory. This is what I had thought about when I thought about 81. So I worked in the wine business before cannabis. Like many of us cannabis professionals, we started with wine and spirits. So a long career with that. And I always compare the Grateful Dead eras to vintages. Right. So there was vintages that were great, you know, for all the different wine regions. And for the Grateful Dead, you can clock them in as, four or five vintages that are gather a lot of attention, late 60s, early 70s, late 70s, late 80s. And I like to say that from every great vintage, there's some, wines that aren't so great. And from other vintages that have been skipped over for notoriety, there's some awesome fucking wines out there. So I felt like this just fits into that. 81, it's not a vintage anyone thinks about, but that doesn't mean there isn't some incredible grower that had some outstanding wine from that
year. Can't disagree with that. You know, I think 81 is not necessarily a year that's listed in the top five by the Grateful Dead. But on the other hand, I think as you have encapsulated, and as Rob pointed out at the beginning, it's one of those years, that does tend to get overlooked. And when you really kind of do a deep dive, and this is why, I say when Rob tries to say I'm the main guy, I always laugh it off because he's the guy that knows about, these shows to bring them back in and kind of give us the full circle picture. So this is really a great one to talk about. And we're going to look forward to getting to it in a few minutes. You can have as much time as you like to talk about the Grateful Dead. We don't stop until we're done, just like them. But please, Stacey, give us a little bit of background. Tell us where you're from, how you got into cannabis, and how you wound up doing what you're doing today. In 2 minutes, go.
2 minutes, go. So I am a third generation San Francisco Bay Area native, born and raised on the peninsula. And I moved to Atherton from Millbrae in 1977. And my family moved into the ranch on Tuscaloosa that Bob Weir grew up in. So that's my crazy out there story. And as a small child, I didn't realize the significance, but in the late 80s, right after we moved, I started going to shows in Shoreline and felt like I was the hottest shit in the stadium while I was watching Bobby play. Like, oh my goodness, we grew up in the same bedroom and had the same bus stop or, whatever, but it's a really interesting part of the journey.
But you didn't find like any, hidden Bobby mementos buried in the house, his old diary or something like that?
Well, there was a family in between, so they probably cleared that out. But we did have the same ranch, and after we sold it, it got knocked down, and there's probably been five, McMansions that have been put up, since then. But, the pool and the pool house, is the classic ranch. So we were the last owners that really lived in that same, vibe.
So how big was the property, man? Because Atherton definitely has some, used to for sure have some bigger properties. You had to have at least a couple acres there, huh?
The minimum is an acre to be in Atherton, and I think it was just over an acre. So we had living in New England, it's so hard to actualize an acre there versus an acre here now. But it was just over an acre, and it was a nice home, but it wasn't anything, that was nothing that was over the top, but nice pool and a couple yards, and there was a big...
Now, wait a second, though. Were any of your neighbors, while you lived there, also neighbors of the Weirs?
Yes. And in fact, the band played in the backyard, and neighbors said that the day the band played in the backyard when Bobby was living there, and they all met in Palo Alto and Kepler's. And I mean, that was the home ground, cruising around Menlo Park, Palo Alto.
Yeah.
Wow. Very cool.
Well, and I think it's before all the venture capital guys moved into Atherton, huh?
Wild, right? I mean, wild to think about it. I've taken my kids home there, and then we've Googled, cost of housing, versus here. And I'm like, no, it looks like home, but it's $5 million for this house, No, we're not moving here, but
right. It
sure is gorgeous.
Yes.
But so I worked in the wine and spirits business, starting when I was 21 years old. I was waiting tables and figuring out what to do with life, and thought the people who came in with the wine bags, pouring wine and talking to the managers, looked like everyone was having a really good time. So I broke into that at 21 and did that out there for about 11 years. And I met a New Englander through work, and I moved back here to his hometown in Western Massachusetts in 2005. And continued in the wine and spirits business and a deadhead all the while. But I have to be honest, I kind of took a step back, you know, from moving and getting involved in your career. And, you know, it was another stage in life where it was always in the background, but wasn't really in the forefront. And then got a bit of a, what I like to call a born again deadhead, you know, deep dive after the Fare Thee Well. And I feel like I'm in pretty good company with that, but it really is kind of wild how much life can change in 7 years.
It's so funny you say that, because I know so many people that kind of, you know, put the Grateful Dead on pause for quite a while and then either went and saw the shows in Santa Clara or went and saw the shows in Chicago and came out with it like just kind of a fully renewed vigor for the music of the Grateful Dead after the 2005 shows, or 15 shows, excuse me. So, you know, cool to hear you say that, but, you know, for me, like, you know, it was a dream pairing. I mean, I'm a huge Trey fan as well, so it was an easy one to convince me to go to. But that was the first time, like, I mean, I never stopped listening to the Dead, but that was the first time I made a conscious effort of, like, I am dropping everything, I'm packing up, you know, and I'm heading out and seeing shows. So super cool that, so for the last 7 years, you're back on the bus, huh?
Absolutely, and kind of the ethos of the podcast and the social media support was when that all started, I was like, gosh, I want to get in the conversation. And what was real different was social media, right? So I'm on Facebook and I was never a personal Facebook person. It's not really my jam, but I started seeing the pages, Aces Back to Back. Scott Allen was the first one and I bought his book and I was like, wow, this is so fucking cool. And then I bought Dennis McNally's book and I was like, wow, I had never really dug into this. So this is a fantastic story. So I emailed Dennis McNally and he emailed me back and said, yeah,
he's the world's nicest guy.
Nicest guy. And he's like, yeah, I'll chat with you. And I said, I want to get in the conversation more than a Facebook page, but I'm a liquor saleswoman. I'm a mom. I've got a couple kids, you know, I'm not a media person at all, but I have something to say. And I want to talk to the Deadheads. I want to share their stories. Everyone gets so happy when they talk about the Dead and so excited when they hear the music. And I want to bring that to life, but not like there's no way a documentary or something with that level of, you know, commitment is in the cards. So it started a podcast and it was in 2016. And the thought was to chat with Deadheads and I would do a set list around them. So the idea was that they would send me the music in advance. I would chase down their moments and then we would chat and then play the music and then chat and play the music. And that's pretty much it. So it was just a basement chat with, you know, people I met on Twitter. And then it went into meeting more Grateful Dead family members and stayed in touch with Dennis and Susanna was on it and Geraldine was on it. And, you know, it morphed into different things. But I loved just going back to that Deadhead that, you know, you parked next to and you went inside and you did boogied next to and you had no idea that you'd ever meet again. And just hearing those stories just from the crowd, from the people is like the best for me.
Right. And then a week later, you walk into a completely different arena and they're still sitting right next to you. And you're like, how the hell did that happen? So
totally, yeah. Magic.
You again.
Yeah, magic. It's the magic of the Dead. So I loved being able to bring a voice to them and the young people too. I had quite a few episodes that I call 21st century Deadheads. And they were the kids that, you know, were the kids of kids or the kids that got turned on the same way I did through, you know, American Beauty or they saw Further, you know, whatever their story is. Everybody's story is so special and unique. So, yeah.
Well, except my kids. My kids got into it because for 10 years, every time we drove from Chicago to St. Louis, I made them listen to the Grateful Dead to the point where they got so sick of it, they didn't want anything to do with it. But a few years later, when they got old enough, you know, they remembered. And I said, you know, listening to the Grateful Dead will never get you into trouble. And when you go to college and you're walking down the hall or people are walking down your hall and they hear you playing the Grateful Dead, the cool people will walk into your room. So, you know, just use it for that. And I think it's worked out well for them.
Strangers stopping strangers.
Oh, ah, my God.
That's right.
From your lips to the universe's ears, man. My kids are so over me. But we'll see what happens. But I'd love that.
So Stacey, I feel like we're missing some years here. If you were in Atherton and then, you know, took a job in the wine industry in your 20s, in your teens, you obviously probably started seeing some shows on the peninsula. I think you told me your first show was 4:30 88 or thereabouts at the Frost Amphitheater. Is that right?
Absolutely. So my Auntie Annie, my dad's sister, she graduated from high school in 69 in San Francisco. So she was the street kid, right? Like she, everyone came to the park and she was there to give them, you know, show them the ropes.
Auntie Annie's pretzels in the airports?
No, but yeah, Auntie Annie, my super special Auntie Annie. She's a just absolutely my spiritual, you know, leader, like amazing person in my life. And she, the first time I thought of the Grateful Dead when I was a kid, she played Ripple and said she wanted it at her funeral. So that was like the very first conversation. So the first show, I'm a kid. I don't know what that means. Of course I do now. But my first show was with Anne and her husband, and we went to Frost, and you know, it was obviously local hometown, and kicked it off there with shows, and then, you know, grew up going to Shoreline and Oakland Coliseum and Cal Expo and Civic Center and, you know, the Northern California run. I was living in San Mateo, went to San Mateo High School. And yeah, I just stayed on the peninsula until I moved out here in 2005. So moved from Atherton to Foster City, but my family's all still there. So San Mateo family.
So you never did Napa or Sonoma when you were working in the wine industry? I figured you had to have done a stint up there.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, you name them and I probably represented them over the years. A lot of, I did some time with, Terlato Wines. That was Rutherford Hill and Chimney Rock and Markham.
Great names.
Spent some time working for Maryvale Vineyards. I was their winery direct person when I was in my early 20s before they did distribution with Southern Wine and Spirits. Worked for Constellation Brands when they were Franciscan Estates, Franciscan, Simi, Mount Veeder.
Back when they were a wine company before they became a beer company.
Exactly. No, lots of really amazing experiences in Monterey and Carmel. And yeah, I could burn off both your ears when it comes to all of those fun stories from that little time. But yeah, and then out here to work for a wine, Mionetto Prosecco, so a lot more focus on European wines versus California out in the East Coast, but managed wholesalers and managed marketplaces, and yeah, a lot of meat on those bones for the wine and spirits. But then I wanted to get into cannabis. I love wine, but you know, I love weed more, and it's such a fascinating industry that I got pretty focused on it and ended up starting with a INSA out in East Hampton about 3 years ago. And so that was really exciting. I was boots on the ground wholesale for them, and I was working with the Dart, which was their proprietary vape. But then the vape ban happened in Massachusetts on was September 24th, 2019. Charlie Baker threw the hammer down, and that was sort of the beginning of the end.
Yeah, he did.
I mean,
we pushed back on that pretty hard, though, huh? I know Chalene Tidal took him to task for that one.
It was a very, you know, I'll say this, living in Massachusetts, especially in these last few years, I have, I have a ton of respect for how Charlie Baker has managed our state. You know, I really have really good things as a resident of Massachusetts, except for that fucking vape ban. Like, and the thing is, it was how he did it. It was like, I'll never forget. I went to the dispensary. I went to the cultivation at like 4 o'clock, and the news went down at 2:30, and everything was quarantined. So, you know, it was just a turn on a dime. No one had any lead time to prepare for it. So I think that was the most jarring thing about it, was just how quickly it was expedited.
He did something roughly the same during the beginning of COVID with essential versus non-essential. You know, Baker stepped in and then backed off his position, you know, pretty quickly on that as well. So, you know, I think Charlie's done a nice job. And obviously, like, to be a moderate Republican in the Commonwealth, you know, you have to be able to get along with a state house that's, you know, primarily sitting in the opposition party. So I think Charlie's navigated pretty well. And, you know, you heard it here first. There are moderate Republicans still out there, folks.
I'm into Charlie Baker. I mean, I use him as the moderate example when things get partisan. Again, not to be partisan, but I was like, you know what? This guy, yeah, he's moderate.
A few more of them and we'd have, you know, we'd be in business.
Amen. But anyways, we're not here to talk about politicians and throwing stones, right? We're not throwing stones here. We're not throwing any stones. We're here to talk about weed and music.
Exactly.
But yeah, so I started doing that, and I've been in the wholesale gig. Currently, I work for Garcia Handpicked, which is, I mean, see here how everything lead up to this day. I work for the Genderson family, and launched the brand out here in Massachusetts in East Hampton, and I am their chief deadhead, and all good things.
That's awesome. When the brand first came out in Massachusetts, my son lives in Boston, and I was out there visiting him, and we, you know, they have a local dispensary, but the local dispensary wasn't selling any of the Garcia Handpicked, and wherever they were selling it, it wasn't anywhere near where he was, so we never got around to getting it. But I told him it's a good thing because this will give me lots of motivation to come back and visit you. You just have to find out where we can get this stuff. I've been lucky enough to be able to try it in my visits out to the West Coast, and it's, you know, let's just put it like this. We don't have anything similar in Illinois, so I'm very happy to go out there and try that, and it helps that it's Garcia branded too.
Yeah, it's pretty rock star, and they're phenomenal people. They're deadheads. Their background is in the wine and spirits business, and they're deadheads, and it's really organic. So it's been a real pleasure.
Cool. Excellent.
And I'm guessing that means you've gotten to spend some time cruising around in Bertha.
I have, yeah. I have. We did the tour out here, and I got a little involved with the California tour. We brought Bertha to Haight Street and had a real good time with Love on the Haight, and Guberman came and played, and we had Bob Minkin and Susanna Millman signing books and signed books for the bus, and it was all love. So yeah, it's been very cool.
Now, did you get to ride on the bus from the East Coast all the way out to the West Coast? That would be a fun cross-country trip, I think.
It'd be a lot. It was a lot. No, I just got to hop on and off the bus in between the hotel gig. But it was really special, and all good things.
Wonderful. Well, if there's going to be, a brand in the, a celebrity brand in the marijuana industry, it's certainly going to be a Garcia brand, I think, and you're dealing with a dedicated customer base who will buy anything that he puts his name on, let alone something that, 90% of them probably enjoy to one degree or another. So that's very exciting stuff. But tell us a little bit about the Strangers Stopping Strangers and where it's gone. For instance, what's the best story you think you've heard so far?
Oh my goodness. That's like asking the best song, right? What's your favorite? Come on, Larry. There's no favorites. They're all our children.
Well, not a favorite, but one that really moved you, maybe, in a way that, you hadn't anticipated, or, was really just kind of like, wow, that's a very cool story type of thing.
It's hard to articulate at the time. I have to say, in retrospect, emotionally for me, probably the most special one is Gerilyn Brandelice. She was, it was the Jerry's birthday. It was the 75th birthday. And I mean, Gerilyn has the most amazing stories, and she was the most beautiful woman who was, really ushered into connections within the Grateful Dead family. And, now that she's passed, to have that experience and to have become friends with her, that we met via, she was going to be on the podcast, but we were friends for years. And so I think looking back, I think Gerilyn's podcast is celebrating Jerry's birthday is probably the most meaningful in looking back to, heartstrings.
Wonderful. That's a great story too. And sure. I mean, Gerilyn is an often underlooked part of the Grateful Dead family, but very important nonetheless. And, to get people like that, who are willing to come on and share their stories with you. What I've heard, like even just, listening to, the Big Steve Hour, right? And he starts talking about stuff. And a lot of the stories, he winds up telling on their face seem, I don't want to say normal, but that could be anybody, but yet it's really more than that, isn't it? Because I mean, this is Big Steve talking about episodes that happened, when he was traveling with the Grateful Dead, and that's what all of us as deadheads, I think, there's this natural curiosity of, these guys are up on stage and they're doing their thing all the time. And there's this, kind of select group of people that, are part of their immediate surrounding. And, there's just a natural curiosity, what's the Grateful Dead like on that side of the fence? Although I think where I came away with that was I was always very happy being on my side of the fence, because I just enjoyed listening to him. And I was a sports reporter, a journalism major when I was in the University of Michigan undergrad. And it was a lot of fun. I got to go to a lot of great games. But one of the things that was a little disappointing is you got to really see what kind of assholes these athletes really were. Not all of them, but enough of them that it just, almost kind of took the fun out of it. And I just always said to me, not that I can imagine it would be the case, but what if Garcia just turns out to be an asshole. What would that do for me? You know? So I'm like, right, you guys go do your thing. I'm very happy to be over here and listen to you play your music. And not to say I would have ever turned down a chance to chat with him, but, you know, that was just my justification for the way it all went down. But that's great stuff. That's really exciting.
Well, and you know, I definitely have to say, thinking about the different podcast guests, and this is really important part of the journey, is how I met Sherilyn was through Deb Solomon with Wall Street Dead Ahead. So Deb was one of my first connections.
We need to get Deb on this show. I love Deb.
Deb is the best. And Deb, I have a funny Deb story on podcast, but she was never on it. She will be 75. If I ever come out, we call her the elusive 75 because I stopped at 74. Because Deb doesn't do podcasts, but she sure sends a lot of guests my way. A lot of amazing people. But I met Sherilyn through Deb. So Deb said, you two got to meet. You know, she was doing the wheel and wanted to have a connectivity. So I met Sherilyn through Deb and, you know, Rex Foundation and events. And that's really, you know, was the conduit to cultivating this relationship. And my favorite old guard story that just came to mind is Wall Street Dead Ahead 2017, and it's the fall, and they do their, you know, annual party, and Susanna Millman is part of Wall Street Dead Ahead, and Sherilyn was, and Rosie McGee is. So they did the before event and, you know, the mixer, and towards the, you know, middle end of the mixer, Deb says to me, Stacey, can you take the ladies out? You know, I want to make sure that they go out, they have a nice dinner, they're in the city, I've got a bazillion things going on for tomorrow's event. Well, you know, why don't you go to dinner with them? So I did. And it's just like this crazy cherished memory of we went to this, you know, tapas place and had sangria. And, you know, we're, you know, these women in their early 70s. And we talked about their grandchildren. And we talked about politics. And we talked about the sangria. And it was the most normalized conversation you could ever imagine, having dinner with Phil's chick, Dennis's chick, and Mickey's chick, right? And they're just these amazing ladies having tapas, and, you know, just maybe I'll have that second glass of sangria anyways. We're in New York City, ladies. You know, it was so much fun. So yeah, Wall Street Dead Ahead and Deb has been really ushered in some amazing stuff.
So let's do a quick shout out to Deb Solomon. For those of you out there that aren't familiar with her, Wall Street Dead Ahead puts on events in New York City for a lot of people that are in the financial community in New York, but it's certainly morphed out of that to, you know, be more welcoming of a lot of different people. But they're always really fun events. It's always packed the Deadhead. She does it at different bars or different venues around the city. And I've only been to a few of them, but everyone I've been to, I've bumped into tons of old friends, and I met tons of other people through those friends that are just really fun. So it's this huge community of Deadheads in New York, and Deb is the conduit to bring them all together. So hats off, and, you know, cheers to Deb Solomon.
She's amazing. And she's, and I'll just kind of throw in for them now, like, she's been doing these really amazing networking events via Zoom, you know, acclimating to our current world. And it is just, you know, keeping the momentum going with Deadheads mixing with other Deadheads to come to the table with, you know, what their focus is and what, how people can help one another. You know, just, it's really beautiful.
That's very cool. And one of the things that I like about your project is that, you know, it's always great to get, you know, people like that on, because they obviously bring a level, you know, of insight and whatever that the average Deadhead might not have. But what always amazes me is when those types of people are telling their stories, they sound, you know, very normal. It's not like they're doing anything that much more out of the ordinary than the rest of us. It's just who they're doing it with that kind of, you know, really makes it interesting. And on the flip side of that, you know, I found, you know, like, say, you know, sitting down and talking to the Deadhead sitting next to you, you hear amazing stories from people who just, you know, otherwise seem, you know, just as run of the mill as I'm sure I seemed everybody else, you know, but every Deadhead has great stories. And, you know, you could sit down and they tell their stories, and it makes me remember five of my own that I hadn't thought of in years. So, you know, I really like that idea of, you know, the community coming together and sharing stories and, you know, engaging with one another like that. It's a great thing.
It's all about the mix. All about the mix, right? It's all about the mix. Have everybody, you know, there's a there's a family member in every, you know, we're everywhere, right? We're everyone, we're everywhere, we're, you know, we're business people, we're, yeah, we're living on the streets, we're kids, we're moms, we're, you know, we're everyone and everywhere. So it's really beautiful.
Hey, so Stacey, are you watching any of the sort of other iterations of different bands that are forming and, you know, playing Grateful Dead music? And are you watching any of, like, you know, J-Rad or Billy and the Kids, or did you get a chance to see, you know, Bob Weir's play with Billy Strings? A couple of videos just came out from Nashville last week. Have you had a chance to check any of that out?
I have. Tremendous. I saw that we're going to dig into a little bit of the Franklin's The Helps of Frank. Yeah, no, for sure. In fact, I'm supposed to go down to the West Bowl on Saturday to see J-Rad with some friends. Really great gang. And I love it. I went to Skull and Roses. Rob, we talked about that for a couple of minutes, which was, I mean, just really bringing it back to the local people, the local scenes, the local bands. I mean, I had such a great time, and getting to see the China Cats from Santa Cruz and Electric Waistband from San Diego and Roots of Creation, you know, shout out to them, came out from New Hampshire and did their Grateful Dub and Brown Eyed Women. And I mean, I could go on and on, getting to see all these iterations and different ages and the women and the reggae and all these different vibes playing together was, it was everything. Nice.
And Larry, did you get a chance to listen to the Billy Strings with Bobby?
Oh yeah. I went in and listened to the clip you sent and then just kept listening.
Well, maybe, Dan, do you want to cue that up and play a little bit of that for us right now?
Okay, Rob, well, I see what you meant about that note for note on the Slipknot. That's right on. That's as good as I've heard anybody do it besides Jerry.
Yeah, and on an acoustic, too. I mean, you commented on that earlier, but to be able to do it, you know, that clean. And,
right.
And look, I'm just starting to learn about the magic of Billy Strings. And, you know, I've heard it from so many people for the last 3 years. Like, you got to see this guy. You got to see this guy. And only in the last, you know, 6 months have I actually been trying to, like, find some videos or find some music that he's done. But obviously this one, when I heard he played with Bob in Nashville, I immediately, you know, went to go look for it on the internet to see if I could find anything. And, you know, he is truly an exceptional talent. And, and I love seeing, like, a young player who's just that good. And it's like the way I felt like when, you know, seeing a young Jimmy Herring or a young, Trey Anastasio.
Derek Trucks.
Yeah. Derek at yes. 15, where you realize that you're watching someone who's just on a level that's just that much better than most other people and has just such a great feel for the guitar. So, you know, watching Billy do this and, you know, the cool part too is that as you get into the Franklins, Billy lets Bob take the lead, you know, on the electric, but it's a very, very different kind of lead. And then he'll come back in during, you know, the choruses and start jumping back into to playing lead on the acoustic. But it's a totally different style than most Franklins you're used to. But the Slipknot, you know, on the technical parts of Slipknot, he's just nailing it.
You know, and look, with all due respect to John Mayer, who we've talked about plenty on this show, I would love to see Billy step in and, you know, play around with Dead and Company and, you know, and hear his guitar playing on some of that stuff too. You know, when you hear a guy who's that good, you want to surround him with as many pieces of the Grateful Dead as you can to see what kind of a sound they can actually produce. And, you know, I mean, here he is just with Bob, and it's as good a version of Help Slip Frank that I've heard, in, you know, in a long time. And, you know, maybe since I saw, well, you know, Phil and the Quintet do it last fall, but okay, that's, you know, that's Warren. So that's always going to be an exception, but, you know, never. Nevertheless, this guy's, I mean, his guitar playing is when I mentioned Derek Trucks, it's because it's true. You know, there are not that many young guitar players who play really technically so skilled at that level. And, you know, I mean, it's just great to hear. And it's wonderful that there's another generation of great guitar players coming along.
And what's amazing is, like, you know, you always think about what you used to hear about Billy Joel versus, like, an Elton John, right? Where, you know, Billy had to work really, really hard for it to be that good at piano, whereas for Elton, it just came so unbelievably naturally. When you watch Billy Strings play, like that guy, there's just something going on in that guy's head where he gets it. There's a direct line from his soul to his fingers that, that, you know, like most guitar players don't have. And it's so obvious. You're just watching him like just tap out some unbelievably technical stuff, not just in that, but in other things I watched him do. That, you know, the reason he's getting the notoriety he is, not just like with the jam band community, but just like, you know, across all music right now, is he is truly that good. Just unbelievably talented.
Well, I think that, you know, in the current scene, there's plenty of great bands out there. I know Goose has been getting a lot of attention and a number of other bands that we've discussed. But it's not the same as having somebody step forward with that just kind of unbelievable talent that, you know, every group that he plays with, he kind of elevates along the way. And it'll be interesting to see over time whether he settles in with a regular group of, you know, performers and, you know, forms his own band, or whether he just kind of keeps it loose and goes around. But, you know, you mentioned some, you know, big names and other stuff, but, you know, you have to start to think, you know, this is what people, what it must have felt like to see a young Eric Clapton, right? Or young, well, young, only young Duane Allman, right? Or, you know, Jimi Hendrix even. I mean, guys who picked up a guitar and made it sound different than other people made it sound.
For bluegrass, last time I saw this was like when Jeff Austin from Yonder Mountain first came out, you know, and, you know, rest in peace, Jeff Austin. But in his prime, when he was doing his thing, there was no one else I ever saw that, you know, could pick a mandolin the way that guy could. He's like straight fire. And that's why, you know, and again, so naturally, just so easily, it's just, you know, like some people are just born to do something. And Billy Strings is born to play stringed instruments. So I loved it.
I have a theory. I'll jump in. I'm being very nicely quiet back here for me in the background, but I have to say another, like, the vintages theory I have on musicians and artists. So I think artistry can cross over from anything you're an artist at, where you can really, you reach artist level when it's this way that you can just hear this person playing just by the sound of exactly what you're saying, just by its intuitive sound. So you mentioned Eric Clapton, Jimi Hendrix, obviously Garcia, Billy Joel, like, but I feel like coming from wine, or I'm sure within cannabis, or I think of it with food often, like a chef, when somebody can make the exact same recipe as somebody else, but you know who made that food, even though they followed the exact same recipe, that's an artist. And so I love, like, you know, just digging in Santana, like there's just these people when they're playing in the background and you don't hear their vocals, but you just know it's them, you know, because they're just so significant.
Yeah. We've talked about that in the past, Stacey, like, you know, and Larry always uses the example of Morning Dew, that all you need to do is hear that first note and you know exactly who it is. And you know exactly what song it is from just literally one note in the tone, where it's, you know, that distinctive. Oh, first note, Shakedown. Like, instantaneously you go, that's Garcia and that's Shakedown.
It's incredible. No, it's incredible. My husband's a big Beatles fan. So we sit around at night and smoke pot and listen to music and go back and forth on, he indulges me on all my theories that I want to share.
Well, that's what a good husband should do.
Yeah, we read that out. You know, I am going to sign off in a few minutes because as a multitasking woman, my daughter is a softball game that was starting between 6 and 6:30 Eastern Standard Time. So as we're talking and I turn my camera mute on, I've been gathering water bottles and stuff and got a text, when are you going to be at the field, Mom? But yeah, this is so much fun. Yeah, and the last thing I want to do is hop off, but then there lies the balance of life, right?
Yes, it does. Well, Stacey, geez, thank you. I mean, first of all, for even taking the time. I know you're very busy, and we appreciate anyone who's willing to come on and, you know, help move our story, meaning the story of the Grateful Dead and the Deadheads and marijuana in general, forward. And you're clearly somebody who has done that, in a very profound way. And we'll be looking forward to hearing more about some of the stuff you're working on, and please stay in touch with us, and we'd love to have you back again in the future.
Thank you so much. And I'll do a quick plug, Strangers Shopping Strangers. You know, I'm going to be working with the community with Jay Lee is a good friend of mine that I'll be doing some stuff with them, and Woven Free and all different kinds of very cool, like, local deadhead businesses that we're going to blow it out. A lot of the women in the community, and get a lot of videos and pictures, and just get all these small businesses to work together. You know, tour's coming out, the time is right. We're dancing in the streets, and Stranger Shopping Strangers' intentions is to be there and film it and share it and just get everybody up shaking their bones together.
Well, we'll look for you at Wrigley Field this summer.
I'll be there, yeah.
And Stacey, before I let you go, because I never get to do this, and this is so much fun to be able to do, tell us about our guest for next week.
Oh, so speaking of community and work and social media and all that good stuff, so you are going to have the most awesome guest next week. Dave Ellison, Wall Street Deadhead, met him through Deb, got to throw that out, and Deb said, you two have to meet. A wonderful guy. I mean, he is just this enthusiastic, crazy rabbit hole deadhead that has, I mean, doing social media for somebody with that kind of content is ridiculous. And yeah, I can't wait for you to meet him. Very involved with cannabis and was in the Toronto Star for the 420. And I mean, just the most gorgeous location, knowledgeable guy. And just so much fun. I mean, just he and I speak in lyrics. So my husband says, you're going to be the one talking to Dave because he's texting me these lyrics. And I don't know, you know, like, that's you, baby. We'll talk about hockey. So he's but he's really incredible. I'm so excited you guys met. And I can't wait for you to dig in with him. He's got a lot of great insights on all aspects.
Excellent. Well, we will do it and hope you'll be listening as well. And there'll be more great stories to share with all of our listeners.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for having me on. And this is the first podcast that I have been a part of since I stopped mine 3 years ago. So, you know, what a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Well, we are honored and glad you could do it. Go enjoy your game and hopefully the good team wins.
Sounds good. All right. Thanks, guys. Talk to you later.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay, well, thank you very, very much again to Stacey Smith for spending a little time with us today. She's the type of guest we like on this show because she's a nerd like we are, and she can talk about this stuff all day without catching her breath like we can. And
you know what I love? I love that she's like the way Katy Tur is with Phish lyrics, right? She's able to drop them in seamlessly into any part of her conversation.
Yes,
where it's like it comes absolutely naturally, where she knows like where the line fits in. So, it's easy to do when you're writing it, very hard to do when you're speaking it.
I couldn't agree with you more. I did it for my son's wedding. I wrote a toast. But I sat down, I actually wrote it out. It was much easier to do. You really have. Bob Hoban is another one who's really good at that. Bob Hoban drops lyrics into his presentations all the time.
Every time he ever drafts anything, I always notice at least one Grateful Dead quote, at least, when Hoban writes.
But the best part is when he presents, because I think we talked about it when he was on the show, he and a whole group of his buddies, they keep a little game going, how many different references they can slip in, you know, to just otherwise normal and ordinary presentations where, you know, the rest of the world is not expecting it, listening to it, or even understanding what you're saying the way the Deadheads understand it if they're, you know, smart enough to catch it. So it's a lot of fun.
Well, as Stacey said, we are everywhere. And when you slip that in, it makes your head turn because you hear someone else say it and you're like, they get it. It's always really, really fun.
Well, it's true. And, you know, it's when you're part of a large group like that, and I'll just take very quick 30 seconds here to shamelessly plug the University of Michigan for that exact same reason, because, you know, the largest alumni base in the world. I'm wearing a shirt today that's based on a blog that I read. And these guys put crazy t-shirts on all the time. MGO blog. If anyone's out there, listen to it. It's the best Michigan blog around. These guys get it. They're really on top of shit. And they always like have timely t-shirts. So years ago when Michigan was in the tournament, they won a big game and their coach was John Beilein, who was really boring. They asked him after the game, what'd you do to celebrate? And he said, oh, it was so great. We had subs, and they thought it was so funny that they printed up a t-shirt for it. It's in, you know, maize, as we'd call it, in blue, but it doesn't say Michigan anywhere on there. It just says we had subs. We went crazy. So a few years ago, I'm at Jazz Fest and I'm walking around wearing the shirt, and all of a sudden I hear somebody yell, go blue. And I'm thinking, you know, I don't have my Michigan hat on. Why are they yelling go blue at me? And they're pointing at their shirt. My wife says, they're pointing at your t-shirt, dummy. And I'm like, oh yeah, right. You know, go Michigan fans are everywhere. There you go. You know, just like that. So thank you for bearing with me on that that tangent.
Subtle references.
Yep. And those are the best, right? I always kind of thought it would be cool, like, you know, to get older and, you know, like my dad always drove around, you know, in a Olds 98, you know, so not that I ever aspired to drive an Olds 98, but, you know, you get to that age in life where you're driving a nice car and, you know, maybe on the license plate holder, you just put a tiny little steal your face sticker, right? That's just there so the people who want to see can see, the people who don't, and you're so old the cops don't care anyway.
Totally. Hey, so should we talk about some cannabis news from the last week or so? See anything fun going on in the world of weed?
Well, you know, we were just talking about, you know, with Stacey about Democrats, Republicans, and all of that. And it's nice to see that the independent community bankers of America are now getting behind the Safe Banking Act and really trying to make a push for it. And as much as I enjoy that and appreciate that, I'm not sure that, you know, that changes my view. And when I say my view, I really mean your view, which is that we're not going to see this pass on the federal level anytime soon.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. But there's greater and greater support for this bill. But, you know, if I've learned anything, Manchin and Sinema can always crush your dreams. So it's
oh God, please. I know we don't talk politics. That's just so painful to even think about. Yeah. I saw what happened today in that vote. That's
so really that aside, it's, you know, look, there's plenty of other, senators that I don't think will pass this thing either. But at the same time, like, I am finally hearing so many people I know that I trust in the industry. They're going, this time might be different. You know, this time really, you know, we're seeing real support. We're seeing, you know, a real push to try to get this thing done. If not now, you know, before this legislative session is over. So I'm becoming more optimistic. I'm not there yet, but I'm certainly more optimistic. But every time we see another group get on board that actually moves the needle as far as their influence, you know, politically moves the needle, then we're that much closer.
Well, I don't disagree, but one of the things that concerns me right now, and I, you know, and I almost hesitate to mention this because, you know, my concerns are far from what the concerns of everybody else are, and that's this whole Roe versus Wade thing. And what we're seeing, I think, are the sides, you know, really, really digging in hard right now, you know, and into the trenches and saying, look, we're prepared, you know, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, it's going to be all out war from this point on. We're going to have to do this and that, and I'm just concerned that as a result of that, it's going to be harder and harder to find examples of bipartisanship on bills such as the Safe Banking Act or any of these acts that we're talking about that would move legalization of marijuana in the right direction.
I think it's moved anything. It's, you know, like if gridlock was bad before, I think this is such a divisive issue, not just, you know, politically, but just for America in general, that you know, people feel very, very strongly about this issue. And you know, they're certainly picking a team and they're sticking with that team, and they will do whatever it takes to support that team. And you know, what we're witnessing right now is, you know, 30 years plus of a culmination of, you know, trying to get to this point where, you know, if Mitch McConnell pats himself on the back for anything in his career, is he delivered. You know, he delivered what they asked him for. And then he's played a long, long game to get there. And now, you know, the whole country is up in arms about it. And my question is, what did you think was going to happen in 2016? You know, like you knew it was on the table then with Scalia, you know, and Scalia leaving the court. So again, without devolving, you know, into a political discussion, all I can say out there, and you know, sort of hats off to Andy Bernstein over at Headcount and the work that he's done, and you know, all the people that are out there trying to get people to vote. Your vote matters. Get out there and vote. Whatever it is you want to see pass, whatever it is you believe in, your vote matters. And if you're not getting it now, like every time something major happens, you know, and I still hear apathy from people, or I hear them say, oh yeah, well, I didn't like that guy because, you know, I didn't like his commercial, but they know the other alternative is worse. But it's not that they'll vote for the alternative, it's that they just don't vote, right? And it makes me absolutely apoplectic to watch people not exercise the most important right that they're given in this world. The thing that makes our democracy amazing is that you actually have the choice, and they choose not to exercise it, and then they feel comfortable complaining about the result. So it's, you know, look, now is a better time than ever I don't care what your political persuasion is. If you feel strongly about an issue, and this is the one that probably more people feel strongly about than anything else, then this is the time that you should be looking at these midterms saying, I absolutely need to get out there and do whatever I can to support my position. Because this is, as you said, people are looking at this as all out war. And I'm a moderate, right? I don't want all out war. I want sensible policy that happens where we can figure out a way to come to compromise. And that is not the direction we're going, because the more you care about an issue, the more those people will vote when you're sitting there, you know, wondering what you're going to have for dinner tonight.
I think it's very true, you know, and you know, quite honestly, from the perspective of the industry, you know, the thought that comes to my mind is, and you know, I say this, you know, just because I'm hearing it on TV all the time. So, you know, there's a whole crew of conservatives, you know, who are ready to take this ruling with Roe, you know, and this idea of, you know, whether or not the 14th Amendment grants us this, you know, kind of penumbra of, you know, individual rights and things like that. you know, of which abortion is certainly one. And, you know, what other changes are they willing to make? You know, people have been talking about, well, you know, what about birth control? Will they go after that? Or will they go after even something like gay marriage? But then, you know, what's to stop them from going back after marijuana? And to say, you know, more or less, if you're talking about the same level of morality that's, you know, that's motivating so many of these people, you know, I'm concerned all of a sudden you get people who come back and say, well, and by the way, what's with this marijuana being legal? This shouldn't be legal either. And for politicians, that might be a much easier one to collapse on.
Yeah, let's be clear about this. I mean, Roe is 50 years of settled precedent. Gay marriage is, you know, 7 or 8 years now of settled precedent. We don't have settled precedent in cannabis. Cannabis is still remains federally illegal. So this isn't even a question of, you know, turning back on existing policy. That existing policy has still never been put in place. You know, and you can look at states' rights and you can look at a 14th Amendment or a federalism perspective on cannabis in general. And, you know, that, you know, you can take the position that, you know, this is a states' rights thing. And that's what we're being, you know, sort of forced to believe right now. Like, oh, no, this isn't about stripping away constitutional rights. This is about, you know, turning it back over to the states. Okay, I mean, I tend not to agree with that position, but you know, other people may. But in this case, you could wipe it completely off the table. There isn't even a states' rights issue here. It's, you know, here it's a federal perspective of, yeah, you know what, we're not doing that anymore. And whatever we thought we've done to date, you know, it's gone.
But what if they go a step further, and what if they appoint an attorney general and say, we want you to go after marijuana right now? You know, we don't care what the states have said. We think it's illegal. And as far as we're concerned, you can go in there and start busting them. Screw them.
The fact of the matter is they can do it very, very easily. And, you know, I have this conversation with people all the time, and everyone's like, no, we're too well entrenched. And my response is, you know, the industry is already very, very fragile. It's, you know, you look at most of the state markets and almost no one's making money. You know, so many people have their hand in your pocket already, whether it's, you know, your municipality or whether it's the state or whether it's the federal government or whether it's, you know, forcing you to go through things that the illicit market doesn't have to do. But it's already, you know, very, very fragile. And even with that fragility, you know, you're thinking, okay, well, at least we've got scale. All they've got to do is go after two or three of the biggest companies. You know, they go after, you know, Curaleaf, GTI, and Trulieve and make examples of Kim Rivers, Ben Kovler, and Boris Jordan. This thing's over. You know, there isn't a single investor that puts a dollar into the industry after that, and this thing collapses under its own weight. So it's not like, look, I think the likelihood of that happening is very remote, but I thought the likelihood of overturning 50 years of precedent was relatively remote as well.
Right. If 50 years isn't enough to give you some confidence that the framework within which you're operating is, boy, after 50 years, it feels pretty much like it's permanent now. Then the next day, no, it's not. You know, how can you ever, you know, really get to that level of comfort? And certainly, you know, that on one of Dan's other podcasts, MJ Bulls, is, you know, the financing of marijuana. These topics come up and get talked about all the time. And, you know, the elephant in the room always is the federal government, the fact that it's illegal. And, you know, Jeff Sessions proved to be uniquely incompetent in terms of doing anything about anything, you know, notwithstanding all of his screaming and yelling about what he was going to do. But, you know, a guy like Chris Christie or, you know, somebody who's, you know, similarly motivated could step in and really do something.
That's exactly right. I mean, people underestimate, you know, the position that Chris Christie took against cannabis and very vocally took against cannabis. You know, then that guy was a hair away from being the AG. You know, it could have gone either way. But for, you know, Kushner's position on dislike of Christie, Christie would have been our attorney general. So it's, you know, that could happen. It could happen very, very quickly. And so, you know, again, just it says to me, get out there and vote. If you care about cannabis issues, get out there and vote. If you care about any other issues, get out there and vote. Because, you know, Congress will take positions that you may not like. Speaking of which, our next thing we were going to discuss is, you know, Congress is now being asked by major business to really step in on and deal with trademark issues that are happening in the cannabis world. And we've seen it for, you know, many years now where people come out with brands and come out with products that are very, very similar or, you know, kind of ripoff names of existing brands. But, you know, if there's one thing we know about Congress, and mostly on both sides of the aisles, they're, you know, relatively pro-business and they're very much in support of protecting intellectual property rights. So, you know, I'm curious to see what...
Except Walt Disney's.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. You know, currently, yeah. But do we think that, you know, we're going to see more enforcement, you know, coming out where it's, you know, enforcement actions might not be on the greater industry, but it might be on very specific parts of the industry for infringement. And I wouldn't be surprised if we do.
Well, I'll tell you, to me, there's two different things going on here. Number one, it's a shame that the cannabis industry still, for the most part, you cannot, well, on the marijuana side, you still can't really get trademarks. Certainly nothing that's enforceable. And until we have trademarks, every strain they sell in any dispensary anywhere is, you know, a who's best guess of what it really is. And I don't care that you're calling it Blue Dream. How the hell do I know, right? If I buy a Big Mac at any McDonald's, I know it's 2LB patty, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, blah, blah, blah. That's what it's going to be, but it's not the same. And until we, you know, nobody's going to make the investment to take their strain of Blue Dream around the country until they know that they can trademark that name and, you know, really have some ownership with it. And so that's one issue. But the other issue that I was kind of gathering from this article is the Gorilla Glue problem. Right, the strain of marijuana that adopts the name Gorilla Glue
or Girl Scout cookies.
Or right, and I think that those groups are pushing back very hard. And I have to tell you, I don't blame them.
I don't either.
Yep. Right? You know, I mean, it's funny, and we can all kind of laugh about it on the cannabis side. But I could easily see where a group like the Girl Scouts, once they have nothing to do with cannabis on any level whatsoever, and doesn't want to be referenced by them in any way, and they should have a right to say,
it's pretty off-brand.
Right. You know, keep us out of this, you know, notwithstanding the fact that we have Girl Scouts who set up outside dispensaries to sell their cookies, which I just give them a thumbs up for. You know, right. If a company has gone out and you know, spent the time and the money and the political capital or whatever you have to do to build up a brand name, you know, to be able to just step in and tie it into the marijuana industry and say, well, the hell with that. I'm going to make some money doing it. Look, if you get away with it, fine. If the company has a sense of humor, great. But if they object, you got to be prepared to stop. And I think it takes, you know, a lot of chutzpah to even go out and try and, you know, do a knockoff of Oreos in the cannabis industry.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I talk about this very frequently with my Tuesday night dinner partner, your buddy of mine, Dave Branfman, who is, you know, one of the foremost IP, trademark, and copyright attorneys in the cannabis space based out here in California. And, you know, Dave and I talk frequently about what you can and can't do in cannabis. And obviously there is state protections. You know, on the trademark side, there are state protections. And I actually think that Dave has a very novel approach to potentially how to, you know, trademark at the federal level. But we'll leave that until he actually gets a chance to put his plan to action. But you know, for anyone out there that wants to learn more about trademark and IP issues, Dave has a talk that he does on Clubhouse every week on cannabis IP and cannabis trademarks. So if you're on Clubhouse, you know, go check him out. That's Branfman, B-R-A-N-F-M-A-N. But he's terrific in the subject.
He's great. I met Dave at one of the normal conferences, the first time I ever went years ago, and just naturally gravitated to him because I've always liked intellectual property and I, you know, studied it, but I've never been smart enough to really, you know, understand it on the level that he does. But, you know, a lot of times people with that kind of knowledge, you know, can be very short and brusque, and he just couldn't have been nicer. And, you know, we hit it off and we still stay in touch from time to time. So shout out to Dave Branfman.
And a big music fan. Yeah. Big music fan, you know, so, and, you know, another guy that, you know, I like to go see shows with as well. So super cool.
Well, that'll bring me back to San Diego for sure then. So we'll see about that. But yeah, so lots going on in the cannabis world and, you know, hopefully all for the good. I guess that's the only other thing about this that really kind of concerns me. We're sitting here trying to build up a positive image for the cannabis industry. Forget about the intellectual property conflict. What about the fact that somebody's selling cannabis in a package that looks like Oreo cookies? That's attractive to kids, you know, and we're sitting here trying to say we're not targeting kids. We're not Joe Camel. We're not doing anything like that. But somebody like that destroys that credibility in a heartbeat.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. But the counterpoint to that is there's so many great edibles out there that people want to take and they don't necessarily want a, you know, a combustible. They don't want to smoke a joint. They don't want to do a dab. So if you can actually make something that's a really nice, you know, soft chew or a caramel, you know, I do a lot of work with Forefront these days, and Forefront has an absolutely amazing product line of chewies and of marmas and of pebbles, all these different products. But when they package them where every single individual piece is child-proofed, and, you know, the box is child-proofed. So I've got no issue with making something, you know, look appetizing and have a really great flavor and a great taste, but you still have to protect it, and you don't want to make it look identical to something else that a child's going to immediately associate it with a brand they're already very familiar with. There's got to be differentiation. So, you know, I definitely think we need more enforcement on that side to make sure there's no confusion.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And anything at all that can be used by anybody to try to suggest that, you know, the cannabis industry is grooming, which is a very powerful word these days, you know, the next generation to be marijuana smokers will do nothing, I think, but set our progress back because we're trying so hard to display this as, you know, something for adult use and something for medical use. And, you know, we all, you know, try to go out of our way to emphasize guys that we all recognize that, you know, 21 years of age or older has to be the rule and all of that. And I, you know, I, notwithstanding the fact that most of us started smoking marijuana before we were 21, you know, I think as far as official policy goes, that's a pretty good idea.
We also started drinking before we were 21. We also started smoking cigarettes before we were 21. You know, all those things, you know, 21 is set as an age very specifically, knowing that, you know, law enforcement knows that people start a little younger than that, but they're trying to make sure they're keeping it out of the hands of 15 and 16 year olds. And if you allow for 19 year olds, then the age gets lower for when people, you know, first start trying.
And by the way, Mrs. Hunt, if you're listening to this, your son is just joking. He's trying to make a point politically here. That's all.
Yeah, I only drank wine with my parents at dinner when I was 17.
Okay. Yeah. Better.
So, I mean, I guess that's a good segue again into, you know, I was at Hall of Flowers last week, and, you know, Hall of Flowers had every product that you can think of that's out there right now. And it was really cool to get to walk the floor. And, you know, this is the only show that's truly a buyer's show where, you know, every single company is out there displaying their wares. You can actually purchase, you know, from a lot of the companies. So as consumers are going through, they can, you know, go out there and try and purchase all sorts of different things from all these different companies. And there's probably, I don't know, 200 plus companies that are represented out there. Lines out the door of people purchasing. You know, it's a place also where tons of business is done between the dispensaries themselves and the brands. A great way where, you know, sales reps don't necessarily have to go out there and knock on doors, but, you know, the buyers from these dispensaries can actually go into your booth and say, okay, show me your entire product line. So it's a really, really different style industry conference as comparison to like MJBiz or to a lot of the investor conferences. This one is truly like, you know, for the industry, by the industry, representing, you know, what we're actually putting out there. So on the side of, you know, if you want to see what was happening with flower, you want to see what's happening with vapes, you want to see what's happening with edibles, it was as good a cross section of the California market as you can find. And it's just a hell of a lot of fun. So, you know, hats off to the Hall of Flowers team for putting on a great event. You know, I would like to see a little bit more participation by the public. I think they need to get the word out a little bit better to get some more people in there. But in terms of industry attendance, it was really, really well attended.
Excellent. I know that also we've been meaning for a while now to give a happy birthday shout out to Billy Kreutzmann, who turned 76. Billy the Kid, the young drummer, Billy the Drummer, I think they called him at the start, right? And here he is today, you know, one of the founding members still, you know, carrying the torch around. Have you heard anything about how he's doing these days physically?
I haven't, but I haven't heard anything bad. So that's the more important thing. So, you know, I think he's probably doing okay. The health I've been watching most recently is your boy in Chicago, Jake Sinninger from Humphreys McGee, to see how Jake's doing. So, you know, I sort of take it one musician at a time to see how they're hanging in.
Yeah, no, it's tough all the way around. And, you know, these things happen. And, you know, when you've devoted time and energy to a band, it definitely makes it tough. But, you know, I mean, I'm sure people were bummed at the end of the last tour last year when Billy wasn't available to play and, you know, he wasn't going to be able to make it down to playing in the sand. And, you know, look, let's face it. If you're going to see Dead & Company, you're going to see Dead & Company to see the guys from the Grateful Dead. You know, I mean, yes, it's nice to see O'Teal and it's nice to see John and all that. But, you know, the selling point is that you got the two drummers and the one of the lead guitar players up there doing it. And, you know, Jay Lane is an excellent drummer. And when he fills in, he does a very, very nice job. And even though Kreutzmann is, you know, far from an extravagant drummer, and, you know, and other than the fact that he always wears that baseball cap these days, you notice the sound when it's not him, right? When he's got his distinctive sound. And when he's not up there, it doesn't matter how good they are and what they do, it's not Bill Kreutzmann. And, you know, that's a real loss. So hopefully Billy is better and can continue to play into the future. And speaking of other things related to the Grateful Dead that I wanted to get to last week, our good buddy Dave Lemieux has dropped yet another of his Dave's Picks, this time number 42, late February show, 1974 from Winterland. Somewhere in the next couple of weeks when we have time, we will dive into that one and give it a review, even though chronologically it's kind of out of order with where we are on the calendar right now. But we like to get to these new releases when they come out. But the little bit that I've heard of it so far is just outstanding. And of course, also with it this time, you get the Dave's bonus disc for 2022, which is a couple of songs from the night before. And apparently the night after 224 was an earlier Dave selection. I want to say 13, also from this set. So apparently this is a run of shows that Dave likes very much, and I tend to trust his judgment on those things. So we will look forward to giving that a review shortly.
Nice. Well, should we skip back forward 7 years from 74 to 81 and check out a bit more of this Cornell show.
Let's do it.
So I know that you and I talked about this last one. I don't even know if we played a clip on it, but we always discuss whether or not, you know, Nobody's Fault is Nobody's Fault or Spoonful. And they play a pretty fun jam in this set where, you know, they play a Spanish jam in this set and then later on play a Nobody's Fault jam. But it definitely has sort of, you know, the hint of Spoonful as well. And, you know, hard to say which is which, but it's very, very clean as far as like a Nobody's Fault jam. And again, they weren't singing the lyrics to it. I don't think that started happening until I want to say 91, but you know, here's a 1981, Nobody's Fault jam that I think Dan's got queued up for us.
Well, I'm going to say Nobody's Fault, but only because I know, because, you know, it's written in front of me, but I can easily see where if I was at the show and, you know, caught up in the midst of all of it, it might be difficult to make the call. And that's, you know, not unlike certain tunes, you know, that come up and have a little bit similar sound to them. And, you know, you typically have to wait until either Jerry or Bobby walks up to the microphone, or in this case, Jerry. And, well, no, that would be Bobby on Spoonful too. So yeah, you know, but you know, Nobody's Fault is a great tune. You know, we've talked about that, Kansas City show from September 3rd, 1985 at the Starlight Theater that I happened to be at, where they played an amazing version of it. And, it's a great song. And, you know, an old Blind Willie Johnson tune from the, you know, the late 1920s, you know, made famous again by Led Zeppelin, in the mid 1970s on their Presence album, which I always liked because it's that stupid shot of the nice couple having dinner with their family inside the yacht club or whatever. And I never really understood what that was all about, but it was a great album. And I remember listening to this tune on this album, but at the time, you know, not having the background on it to understand that it was any, I just figured it was another Led Zeppelin tune. But you know, once you get to know what it's all about, it's a great song, and Jerry really loved playing it. So, it's always nice to share any part of that, with or without the lyrics. So, good selection on that. And I guess we're at the point where we're probably running out of time here. So, maybe we'll just kind of in a second here, skip to the final one. We do have a great show next week with Dave Ellison of the Scarlet Fire Dispensary, coming on to join us. And, we're excited for that. Please tune in then. I think we're going to, for our music, rather than necessarily talking about any single show, Rob and I are going to sit there and throw in our favorite versions of Scarlet Fire. And maybe Dave will be kind enough to hit us with one too. And we can sit there and go through that combination, which is certainly, since its inception in the mid to late 1970s, the combination of those tunes has risen to the top of most Deadheads' favorite song combinations, right up there with Help Slip Frank and China Rider and some of the others. But Scarlet Fire kind of tends to stand out on its own. So I know we've got our work cut out for us on that one, Rob, just figuring out which ones we like.
We do. And then the following week for our listeners, we've got Todd McCormick coming on, who's one of the best known, you know, genetics guys in cannabis, Todd McCormick Seeds. Most people know him because he's kind of the person that they kept the flame alive for Jack Herrera. You know, it's been in the space for years and years, big Deadhead, and lots of fun stories. I've had a chance to do a couple things with Todd in the past, and I'm super fired up that he wanted to come on the podcast. So I think we've got him in 2 weeks. So we've got some good stuff lined up. And our buddy David Gantz just introduced me to Terry Haggerty yesterday. And so I think Terry's going to hopefully come on the show with us soon. So I've got to reach back out to him. But, you know, shout out and say thank you to David Gantz for making the connection and unsolicited saying, hey, Rob, you know, this is a person that you should definitely try to get on your show. And so hopefully we can do that. And, you know, we've got lots of other stuff coming up. So that's it for me for this week, and always a good time. And that was thank you to Stacey Smith for coming on, and thank you for Stacey Smith for getting Dave Ellison for us next week. But you know, I really feel that we're getting some great guests right now, and it's making our lives that much easier, Larry, and that much more fun.
Absolutely, Rob. Couldn't agree with you more. We're going to go out with Dan treating us to the lovely strains of the Grateful Dead playing Althea from the show in Barton Hall in May 1981. As usual, it's a killer version of Althea, as Garcia tends to do. And as we head out, I just want to shoot out a message to those two kids who were sitting behind me in Folsom Field a few years ago at Dead & Company. And as Dead & Company started to play Althea, and they were raving about it because they know it's John Mayer's favorite tune. And one of the guys finally said, I think he plays it better than Garcia. Dude, listen to this version right now and then reconsider that position. God love you. Thank you to all. Thanks to Stacey Smith and to Rob. Thanks to our producer, Dan Humiston. We will talk to you guys next week. Be good, stay safe, and enjoy your cannabis responsibly.
about listening and forgetting the love we bring.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Season 1 of Dope History is now available at dopehistory.com. Dope History weaves you through the lives of those who have been touched by cannabis or have had an influence on the events that shaped our laws or relationships with this plant. You'll hear tales from Frenchie Cannoli, Keith Strop, Eddie Lepp, Tom Alexander, Ed Rosenthal, Wolf Seagall, Jorge Cervantes, and Tommy Chong. Available now at dopehistory.com.